Okay, so this is the first Tuesday night of the month, and ordinarily Norma, one of our teachers, will give the Taisho or the Dharma talk on Tuesday nights, but when she's not here, I do, and I usually call it, with big air quotes, Buddhism 101. I try to keep it very basic and straightforward and not get very esoteric. In fact, most of my talks, I think, are like that, but I really work on it on these first Tuesday nights. So I'm going to start by reading a very short koan out of the Mumonkan, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but let me read the koan first. And we'll use this as a takeoff point for what we'll talk about tonight. So this is case number 37 in the Mumonkan, and the title of it is The Oak Tree in the Front Garden. And the case goes like this. A monk once asked the master Joshu, "What is the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the west?" Joshu answered, "The oak tree in the front garden." So I'll just define a little bit of the substance of this case, and then we'll zoom out a little bit to the Mumonkan and then to Zen in general. So Joshu was a great Zen master. He was alive during the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty, which went from around the year 500 to 1000 in China, where Zen began. In China, it was called Chan. And when it came to Japan, around the 12th century, it was transliterated into Japanese Zen, and that's what stuck for us in the West. So we call it Zen, but actually it was originally called Chan. Now the patriarch was the person, his name was Bodhidharma. He was one of the folks in the lineage down from the Buddha in India, who was a great teacher and master and Dharma master in India. And he made a very long trip to China, and brought this teaching to China. Buddhism had already entered China a little bit, but he brought the teachings of the meditative sect of Buddhism, the sect that wasn't philosophical but directly meditative. And he, because of his personality and his own depth of Zazen, brought this practice to China. So in China, Buddhism took the form of Chan. Now, why was it called Chan? Chan was actually the way that the Chinese, or they originally said Chana, the way that they pronounced the word that Bodhidharma used, which was Dhyana, Dhyana, D-Y-H-A-N-A, Dhyana. So Dhyana means literally in English, it means absorption. So what he brought to China was a practice, the foundation of which was a meditative absorption. And this was in China called Chana, that contracted to Chan and then went to Japan where it's called Zen, and it's called Zen here in the States. So this is a story that I just read. It's a very short story. I read the case. Now in each of these koan in the Mumonkan, there's 48 of them. This is number 37. There's a case, then there's a commentary by the compiler of the Mumonkan. His name was Mumon, Master Mumon. And then he also writes a verse. I haven't read those yet, but I will at some point. So this Mumonkan was actually put together in the early 1200s by Master Mumon. And what he did is took 48 of the koan that had begun to become very a popular way of teaching the truths of Zen in China. He took the ones that he thought were most instrumental, most efficacious in teaching these basics of Zen Buddhism, and compiled them into a book called the Mumonkan. And this has become actually a foundational text in Zen training, particularly in the West, but throughout the world. Anyone using koan to practice Zazen, which is a more advanced form of Zazen, will usually start with this collection, the Mumonkan. And this was case 37. So let's go back to this case for a moment. Keeping in mind what Zen is, this practice of absorption. So here the monk asked this great master Joshu a kind of standard question in Zen at that time in the 13th century. What is the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the West? Now, the patriarch was Bodhidharma. He came from the West. India was west of China. And asking what was the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the West is a way of asking, what was this deep truth that he brought? What was this deep truth? Please explain it to me. He must have made that dangerous 2-year trip in a boat for some very profound reason. Please share with me what that reason was. So the monk asked this standard question, what is the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the West? So you can imagine the monk is expecting some kind of explanation, teaching, a deep truth, something. And Joshu, this great master, he was called a master of lips and tongue. In other words, he had a mastery of words. He was such a master of words that it was said of him that when he spoke, light emanated from his mouth. Just the way that it felt when you were with this man, Joshu. So he answered the monk, the oak tree in the front garden. What a puzzling answer. The oak tree in the front garden. I'm certain the monk was not expecting that. Now this case here, just these words that I read, are utilized by Zen students to have a deep insight into reality, the real world, the basic truth of Zen and Buddhism. Now, how can we understand this? When we were children and we encountered an oak tree, there was a point where we didn't have a name for it. It was a very direct encounter. It was something really big, massive, and it gave shade. And there was a feeling to that experience. As a child, if we could remember maybe the first oak tree we recognized, there might be a certain awestruck aspect to that experience. But what was absent from that experience was any names, any meaning, any understanding of the particular function of a tree or how it could be chopped down to create wood where you could build things. There was certainly no thoughts about other oak trees that we had seen, you know, a la Ronald Reagan. Some of you are too young to remember the statement of Ronald Reagan's. They were talking about logging in the Redwood National Forest in Northern California. He was actually the governor of California. I don't know if he said this when he was governor of California or if he said it when he was president of the United States, but he said, wanting to open up this area to logging, he said, if you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. So that's something definitely that a child would not even begin to think. They wouldn't be comparing this to anything else. They wouldn't have a name for it. They would be confronting this thing And what were they experiencing? For them, this was a sensory experience, a direct, undiluted sensory experience. Now, they were young enough that it didn't trigger thoughts, ideas, meanings, whether or not this tree could be useful if we chopped it down. Whether I want this tree here, I want to get rid of this tree so I have more sunlight, or whatever it might be. All the many things we could think about this tree. The child standing there is just experiencing something that they have no name for. Now, we were all children once, and one of the main tasks of childhood, at least as adults, fashion it, and it certainly is true because adults want us to survive, we have to learn the names of things. We have to learn what they mean. We have to learn how they're used. We have to learn how they fit in with other things. And we begin to learn a name for ourselves. We begin to make a distinction between what we think is a self, because that has a name, and an oak tree, that has a name, and a house, and a car, and whatever else. And little by little, we, in the process of learning how to name the world and give it meanings, begin to lose that awestruck sensation, that direct sensory contact. As we get older and older, we lose it so thoroughly that encountering a thing immediately triggers the thoughts about the thing. And the thing itself becomes rather unimportant. It becomes like Ronald Reagan said, you've seen one redwood, you've seen them all. It's just another example, and we begin to compare this example of something that we're experiencing, seeing, hearing, smelling, to something else that we once experienced. And I remember what I was doing when I experienced that. I was on a trip. I went up to Vermont, and I remember I saw this mountain, and there were these beautiful pine trees, and then we're off and running. Oh yeah, that was my old girlfriend, and she gave me a lot of trouble. In other words, you see this slippery slope. One thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. So what is this dhyana, chan, zen practice? What is it? It's coming back to your actual real world experience, your actual world. It's letting go of the immediate reflex reaction to have a sensory experience trigger meaning. What it means to you, what it means about you, what it means about someone else, what it means about life. So remember, this monk here was asking, what is the meaning of the patriarchs coming from the West? He's looking for meaning. We are addicted to meaning. Now, it's not that meaning is bad. It's not that it isn't extremely useful. It's not that meaning didn't help us develop the world that we have with all our modern conveniences. But in the process of doing this, look at what's happened. We have, in the process of giving certain things special meaning and other things unimportance, in the process of neglecting the sensory direct experience that we have in favor of some overarching meaning, importance, a hierarchy of things that are better, worse, important to me, not important to me, in that process, we have succeeded in leading, making actions that led to the extinction of thousands of species of animals, that have greatly culled the non-human species of animals to a very small number compared to the 7 billion humans on Earth. We have taken the Earth's resources in ways that have severely damaged the climate and the ecology of the earth, our environment. We poison the air, we poison water. You can see these negative things that have come about, as well as all the wonderful positives. Now, we could take meaning further. What have we done with meaning? We've given people pigeonholes. This is a Christian, this is a Muslim, this is a Buddhist, this is a Jew, this is an American, this is a North Korean, this is a Russian, this is a Frenchman. You can see how meaning, just these things that we learned about the world, that were created by thought, that have no real existence, no actual existence, have become so important that we are willing, often, to destroy others or to die for the sake of defending a meaning or a set of meanings. You can call a set of meanings perhaps a religion, a belief system, a creed, whatever you want to call it. And this is the human condition. So what this practice does is it begins to very concretely reverse the process. We go from meaning back to sensation. And from sensation back to the connection that that child first seeing the oak tree had. It is a kind of awe-inspiring connection because we don't know where the dividing line is between what I used to call me and what I used to call the oak tree. When I'm so absorbed in the sensory experience of oak tree, that line becomes very fuzzy. And there's something fresh about this experience. It can't be compared to anything else. It's what we call real. It's our real life, our real world. And this is life-giving. This begins to undo all the harm that the thinking process had created for us, all the difficulties that arose, all the ways we pigeonholed ourselves and other people, all the ways we describe ourselves and describe life, etc. So how do we do this in our zazen? How do we do this? We sit in a posture that keeps our mind alert. The back is taut. The attitude of zazen is intent. All our senses are working. Our eyes are not closed shut. We're not interested in going to a sleepy-minded, soporific state. We're interested in being acutely aware of the actual sensations of whatever the focal point is. So usually for people starting out and people that have sat for many, many years, the breath is a wonderful focal point. Now, why is that? First of all, the breath has no meaning. You can give it meaning, but eventually you'll get bored with that. The breath is always with you. It's never apart from you. It's, in a sense, taken for granted until we look directly at it and examine the sensation of breathing. Just see that this sensation is unique to me. No one else has this particular momentary sensation at this point in time, in this location. It becomes very what? Very intimate. The breath is intimate. So just in the process of observing the breath or counting the breath, rather than giving it any meaning, we are also moving in a direction of greater and greater intimacy with our actual experience, which is the real world for us. It is very healing, very life-giving. Just that simple process. It's that basic. There's no room here for magical thinking. And it's not that magical thinking is absent in Buddhism or Zen. There are people who practice magical thinking in Zen. They believe in hierarchies. They believe in various levels on the scale of enlightenment. They believe that enlightened people have something that unenlightened people don't have. And they make grand claims about enlightenment, about how you'll have this experience and suddenly be turned into one of the world's great bodhisattvas. This is magical thinking. It's much better to just stay very basic and concrete. One Zen master put it this way. He said, there's nothing in particular to realize. Just let go of the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. The notion that you can name this group of people Buddhas and this group of people sentient beings. What do I mean when I say Buddha? A Buddha is an enlightened person. A Buddha, if you look at the actual word Buddha in Chinese, it's two sheaths of wheat that are tied together, lashed together. It's a very simple pictogram. It's elegantly simple. It's taking what was divided and seeing that it's actually one. What's a sentient being? To be sentient means to sense, to know, to sense. There's no distinction, the Zen master said, between a Buddha that is one with his or her every moment experience and a sentient being that is sensing. There's no distinction. There's nothing in particular to realize in this path towards enlightenment. Just let go of the notion that there's a difference between these two imaginary classes of human beings. Let's go back to the koan. So we read the case. In this case may actually have been an actual encounter between the monk and Joshu, and it was written down because it had particular teaching value. So it became what's called a koan, and koan in Japanese means case record. It's almost like the record of cases in a courtroom that set precedents. This is a precedent-setting case in a sense. So we read the case, and the commentary by Mumon goes like this. If you can firmly grasp the substance of Joshu's answer, for you there is no Shakyamuni in the past. Shakyamuni was the Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, and no Maitreya, which is in Buddhist teachings, the Buddha yet to come, the second coming, you might say. There's no Shakyamuni in the past and no Maitreya in the future. Let's look at this for a moment. If you can firmly grasp, this is not about understanding. This is not about comparing, naming, philosophizing. This is about firmly grasping. This is direct grasp. There's no separation. When something is grasped, it's part of you. You don't know where it ends and you begin. You can make it up in your mind, but you really don't know. It becomes part of you. So he says, if you can firmly grasp the substance. So he's not talking about the meaning. He's talking about the substance of Joshu's answer. So the teacher might ask you, if you come into Dokusan, what is the substance of Joshu's answer? Show me right now. Show me the substance. Don't tell me it. Show me it. This is very, very important in Zen training. It's an activity. It's a direct performing of your understanding rather than an explanation of philosophizing. So Mumon says, if you can firmly grasp the substance of Joshu's answer, for you there is no Shakyamuni in the past and no Maitreya in the future. For you there's no thinking about the great masters of old and how you want to be like them, and there's no future Buddha that you will become after a long period of training, because you've grasped the answer and you've got it. Because this is the meaning of the patriarch's coming. This is what Bodhidharma wanted you to learn. He wanted you to learn that the meaning of his coming here was the oak tree in the front garden, the incense wafting across my nose sitting next to the altar here, the sound of the fan in the room. Is that direct? So there's a verse here. And the verse goes like this. Words do not express actualities. Phrases do not embody the spirit of the mind. He who attaches himself to words is lost. To stagnate with sentences is to be deluded. So that's exactly what we've been talking about tonight. So let's see if we have a little more time. We have a few more minutes, and I want to just be very concrete now, because once again, this is Buddhism 101. How do we do this in our zazen? This is a very interesting story, and yes, I do get it, that I've so readily given meanings to things and then been off and running with one thought following another. It used to be that when I saw something, when I had an experience of some sensation, it would create a thought. But now the thoughts are just going on their own. I don't even need the sensation to get the thoughts going. I'm running the tape loop all the time, and I don't even notice the sensations anymore. Matter of fact, yesterday I almost got hit by a truck. It's kind of on that level. So we sit down in our zazen, and we right away notice that we're thinking. Right away. Matter of fact, people who learn this practice early on are convinced that their running thoughts, their what we call discursive thinking, is actually made worse by zazen. They're convinced of it. It's just like a continual flowing of thoughts that are disconnected from anything that you're doing. They're about things you're worried about, things you're hoping for, things you're going to do when you leave the zendo, and things that someone said to you yesterday. So it's not that zazen is making this worse, it's simply making you aware of it, because you've sat down, you've quieted your body and mind, you've decided that you're not going to accomplish anything here, you're not going to get anything done, you're not going to change anything, you're going to learn how to observe what is actual. And what is actual at that moment is the running away of thoughts. How do I deal with that? What do I do about that? It's so frustrating. I'm trying to count my breath and the thoughts come crowding in. Well, I'll tell you the answer. Exactly like Joshu said here. It's the thoughts. He said, oak tree in the front garden. I say, it's the thoughts. It's the actuality of the thoughts. It's the sensation of the thoughts. If you are thinking and you know you're thinking, you know you're thinking because you sense thinking. So all you need to do, and this isn't difficult, although there's a deep habit behind it, you need to just become disinterested for a moment and drop off the meaning of these thoughts. But don't push them away, just notice the sensation of thinking. Oh, that's what thinking feels like. I never noticed before that thinking feels like that. It's kind of like a silent sound. And there's a certain feeling in my body-mind when I'm thinking. But I don't care about the meaning right now because I'm doing zazen and there's nothing I can do about it anyway. So I'm just going to let the thought come in and observe its sensation. And as I do that enough, it may only be a few seconds, then I'm back to the sensation of breathing. Because that's a lot more interesting to me than these stale, old, stupid thoughts, the meaning of which I no longer care about. So that's a little trick to kind of get back on track. So we've reached the end of our time tonight, and we'll end here.